Hello, my name's Craig Barton, and welcome to the Tips for Teachers podcast, the show that helps you supercharge your teaching one idea at a time. This episode, I had the absolute pleasure of speaking to teacher, author, podcaster, and, I'm going to say it, global phenomenon, Ollie Lovell. Two pieces of news before we hear from Ollie. First, a reminder that I've now completed the recording of all 10 of my premium online on-demand Tips for Teachers workshops. Here's the list of the 10 workshops. There's Habits and Routines. Number 2 is The Means of Participation. It's one of my favourites. Then you've got Checking for Understanding, Responsive Teaching, Planning, Prior Knowledge, the biggest one, Explanations, Modelling and Worked Examples. Then you've got a workshop on student practice, memory and retrieval, and homework marketing feedback. I've spent ages recording these. They're full of short, sharp videos, links to research, links to resources, and they're all available at a pretty reasonable cost. So they're available on my online CPD store. You'll find a link to that on the Tips for Teachers website under CPD. And secondly, I'm dead excited about this. The Tips for Teachers book is released on the 6th of January, 2023. This contains over 400 ideas to improve your teaching the very next time you step into a classroom. The production team at John Catt have done an amazing job. It's a beautiful looking book. Again, there's loads of links to online resources and stuff in there. So if you're interested in either pre-ordering or ordering this, depending on when you're listening to it, again, you'll find a link on the Tips for Teachers website under the book section. Anyway, time for me to shut up. So, spoiler alert, here are Ollie's 5 tips. Tip number 1, the limits of working memory are only overcome by chunking and automating into long-term memory. Tip 2, backwards plan, always backwards plan. Tip 3, check for understanding. Tip 4, inquire into mechanisms. And tip 5, you can learn something from everybody. As ever, all the tips are timestamped, so you can jump straight to the one you want to listen to first, and videos of Ollie's tips, along with all the tips from the Tips for Teachers guests, are available on the Tips for Teachers website if you want to watch the video and share them with your colleagues. Enjoy the show. Well, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Mr. Ollie Lovell to the Tips for Teachers podcast. Hello, Ollie. How are you?
Good, thanks, Craig. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Very well. Ollie, for the benefit of listeners, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, ideally in a sentence?
Sure. Well, a little bit about myself. I'm very confused because my face is being recording, not just my voice.
I like it. Give us a bit more, Ol.
Teacher in Melbourne, Australia. 4 days a week at the moment, while I do a few other things like run the Education Research Reading Room podcast, which is why I'm used to having my voice recorded, but not my face. So if I do strange things with my face, it's weird old habits. Sorry, listeners and watchers in particular. I teach maths, as you do and have, Craig. And it's always a pleasure to have a chat with you, mate.
Looking forward to this one. I've done well to go through your many PR agencies to get you these days, Ol. You're getting big these days, but I managed to get a little bit of your time, so I'm very grateful for that. Right, let's dive straight in. What's tip number one?
Tip number one. I'm not used to such a little intro, Craig. I've got to get on my horse straight away. All right, tip number one. Now, this is a kind of a takeaway that will be familiar to people who are familiar with my work, and that is the limits of a working memory are only overcome by chunking and automating information in long-term memory. So the kind of background, the background of this one is essentially, when I was at school, I was always of the view that, like, why would I need to know anything? Why would I need to, and particularly, you know, I mean, history, when we were learning dates and things like that, I was like, this is an absolute waste of time. It wasn't until about 2014 when I started to learn Mandarin Chinese and get a bit serious about my learning and read Dan Willingham's Why Don't Students Like School, that I learned about this whole working memory, long-term memory thing. Now, I don't know, what's the level of background knowledge of listeners of this, Craig? Tell me if I need to go into things or if everyone's already knows about the limits of working memory.
No, give us it. Always good to have a refresher anyway, Ol.
Okay, great. So, and you timestamp all the takeaways, because I'm a listener, so I know people, if they're bored, they can jump straight to the next one. So human cognitive architecture, we can think of it in three main components. There's external, so this is the environment. This is where everything is. This is where our ugly mugs are. Craig, if someone's watching this or listening to our voices, it's where the internet is, it's where books are, it's where colleagues are, and it's an unlimited external store of information. So people can access as much as they info as they want, or they're able to access in the environment. When people pay attention to information in their environment, can make its way into their working memory. And working memory is a limited internal store of information. So depending on whose research you look at, if you look at Miller's research, it's 7 plus or minus 2 kind of elements and associated interactions at any one time. And then when we think about things, when we sleep on them, when we connect them to things we already know and things like that, that information can make its way up into our long-term memory. And when it's in our long-term memory, that's when we kind of say it's been learnt. So the thing is, you know, the odd part out in terms of this whole architecture is the working memory, because it's actually the only limited store of information within this whole store of new information within this whole kind of architecture. And what that means is that when our students get overwhelmed, when they get confused and things like that, it's usually because there's some sort of overwhelm of their working memory. But then the question becomes, well, if students can only hold about 7 plus or minus 2 things in their working memory at any one time, why can they do more next year than they can this year? And why can they do more the year after that than they could next year, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And the answer is by chunking and automating information in long-term memory. And chunking just means we take multiple elements of information. For example, we take the letters in memory, M-E-M-O-R-Y. They're originally a number of elements, and then we chunk them into a single word, and we can use that word flexibly. And then we chunk the word memory into long-term memory, which then becomes a concept which then we can use flexibly. And so this, I mean, for people who are familiar with this, this is covering old territory, but for me when it was new, this was absolutely revolutionary, because I had always just thought that knowledge was a bit of a waste of time. You know, I thought I was a reasonable thinker. I thought I could come up with creative ideas, yada, yada, yada. But it was only really when I learned, well, actually, this knowledge is the foundation of all higher order thinking. And more complex and deep thought is actually just more and more knowledge integrated and interacting in better and better ways. I thought, wow, this is phenomenal. And I completely changed the way that I live my life. I started to be much more focused about building knowledge. And I started to use technology like Anki to try to memorize things. And if I'm honest, in terms of my ability, like in terms of what's helped me to kind of build the knowledge required to continually run the podcast, first to write CLT in Action, then to write Tools for Teachers, in many ways, it's because I've had such a commitment to just not forgetting stuff over the last 7, 8, 9 years or so. So that's kind of the level one of the takeaway. I guess the level two of the takeaway is my learnings since then. I feel guilty for using that word learnings, because I saw Dylan William tweet on Twitter yesterday something like, is there a more aggressive word than learnings? I'm asking for a friend. I didn't follow the thread, but I thought, oh no, I've got to stop using that word, but it's probably too ingrained now. Anyway, I guess that the more recent learning for me in relation to this is how important it is for knowledge to be connected in really authentic ways. So since I kind of learned about the importance of knowledge stored in long-term memory, and in addition the importance of kind of repeating information, spaced repetition, to build and consolidate that knowledge, I've kind of gone on this whirlwind, like cram stuff into my brain kind of a journey. And along the way, there's been a lot of frustration and a lot of forgetting. And it's taken me many, many years of trying to cram stuff into my brain to realize that actually there's only so much that you can take in, and it's only really the stuff that you then transfer, you then apply, you then relate to other new things, and it kind of forms this like connected chain of knowledge that you can continually building upon, that it actually becomes ingrained and part of that long-term memory in a way that you can use usefully. And so I've, you know, had to abandon various learning projects along the way, recognizing that I hear you've just enjoyed reading Oliver Berkman's 4,000 Weeks, Craig, recognizing that, you know, there isn't infinite time in our lives, and to do some things well, we have to kind of reduce other things. And, you know, a further thing, an example of that is, like, if yesterday someone said, oh, Ollie, I was running a PD. They said, Ollie, you do the podcast, you teach, like, how do you fit it all in? And I said, I have no idea about, like, any sport in the world. I haven't watched a sport match for many months. Don't know what's happening in the rest of the world in terms of the news. I listen to, like, the news radio for 5 minutes, like the summary every morning, but that's about it. And I don't know my family's names. No, that's going a bit far. But really, I've just cut out a lot of stuff because there isn't time for it. But also the final thing about this is that I think that when we do recognize the importance of, like, these interconnected, progressively built knowledge structures over time, I think that might even raise questions about the way that we kind of structure school and the kind of breadth we expect our students to cover, and then expect it to stick and expect it to stick in meaningful ways. But yeah, that's a musing more than a conclusion or a tip.
Love it, Ollie. Love it. Right. Three things for me on this, just to dive into. First, I'm interested in how this practically plays out in your teaching. So how does this, what you've learned about the limits of working memory, the importance of connected knowledge, how does that change what you do day to day?
Well, it really just means that I try to build in, and I'm lucky enough that the school that I work at is very good at this as well. We try to build in really structured ways for students to re-encounter core information, core ideas, but also not just kind of re-encounter them, actually retrieve them and use them in practical ways. So, I mean, something that I've been talking about a lot in, like, PDs that I've been running recently is the benefit of daily reviews. And if you're looking for someone, if you're in a primary setting and you're looking for someone who does a really good job of this, David Morkunis has a great video on YouTube. So shout out to Dave. And if you're in a secondary setting, there's lots of different apps and stuff, like, you know, Anaboxx's Carousel, or there's Podsy, which I've been using a bit recently. Or there's just kind of making your own. So it's really about trying to give students enough exposure to content over time. But also another thing is giving them and, like, helping them to overlearn it, and especially overlearn, like, the core content, because that helps to really, really bed it down.
Cool. Okay, just two more things on this. Well, one of my kind of things I'm thinking about a lot at the moment, Ollie, and come back at me if you think this is a load of rubbish, is I think as a profession, we're a lot more research informed than perhaps we have been. Certainly when I started teaching, certainly things have shifted a lot in the last 10 to 15 years. But I think there's still a bit of a gap from, so the research has gone from kind of the studies to the teachers, but I'm not so sure it's found its way to the kids. And I think as teachers, often we do a lot of things, but perhaps our kids aren't aware of why we're doing them and the reasons and so on. So I just wondered, how do we get our kids on board with this? Like, is it important that the kids realize the limits of working memory and so on? Or is it just more important that we just do things in lessons that take account of that?
I actually think it's super important. So the podcast I did just before my most recent one was with a group of two teachers and a researcher. The two teachers are from Churchy Grammar. Churchy Grammar is, like, super focused. I don't know if you saw that episode, Craig, but Churchy Grammar is super focused on teaching or developing self-regulated learners. And they've got, like, a four-year program that teaches students about retrieval practice, spacing, all these kinds of ideas, but they use, like, student friendly language. And, you know, in the research, we call it informed training. It's basically training people, but informing them at the same time, like, what you're training them about and why you're training them about it. And it's to me, it's like, it's the most interesting frontier within education. It's what I'm doing my PhD in at the moment, because I think it's just, we need to get it right. And it's I'm also really excited that the school I'm working at the moment, Brighton Grammar, over the next couple of years, it seems like we're going to look into this space a little bit more in a bit more of a focused way. I'm super excited about that.
Fantastic. And final question on this. Now, we're recording this in the start of August. So I think it was July, Tom Sherrington put out a really good blog that I know you retweeted and I did as well, about quizzing and retrieval practice and how it's become a bit of a lethal mutation that, you know, everyone thinks they're doing retrieval practice, lots of different ways of doing it. And one of the things that came out from Tom's blog that really rang an alarm bell for me is this idea that kind of disconnected knowledge is not necessarily a good thing. You know,
question on 10 completely different areas is not, you know, the way that we want students thinking about retrieval practice. But then I think about how I might start a lesson off with, you know, four questions on four different areas of maths, or how I might do a low stakes quiz where I want 10 different topics from 10 different areas. And I think, am I doing the wrong thing here? Because this knowledge isn't connected, you know, there's a question on fractions, there's a question on area and so on. Do you think, is maths just different in this sense? Are we okay to do that? Or is something bigger going on here? And how does it play out in your lessons, your retrieval practice?
So on that connection point, I would say the important thing is not that the five questions they're doing on a particular day are linked to the other four questions or the content of the lesson. It's about the connection to the student's prior knowledge. So if we have five questions which are meaningfully related to things that the students already know, such that they are able to actually retrieve the content and have a successful retrieval episode, or that when given a few tips or hints or working through with a teacher or a partner, they can build upon something that they've got stably in their long-term memory, then I think that is meaningfully interconnected knowledge, and that's can be a valuable learning activity. I think the challenge comes if that knowledge isn't kind of bedded down sufficiently first, second, third time round, such that the students really do feel like this is five questions, all of which they have no idea what the heck they're doing, and then they just kind of get demotivated or struggle to see connections that could be seen, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I guess that's the way I'd see it. In terms of what it means for my own retrieval, it basically just means that I'm constantly adapting the kind of questions that I'm giving students based upon what I've seen in prior lessons to try to make sure it's in that kind of Goldilocks window of bringing stuff back. So it's a little while ago. It wasn't just necessarily the last lesson or the easy thing. But more importantly than the time break, it's actually that kind of retrieval strength break and in a zone where there's a bit of effort to retrieve it, but it's not so hard that it's out of reach.
Got it. Makes perfect sense. Let me just chuck one more thing at you before we move on to tip two. Another thing, I've been thinking loads about retrieval practice. So Kate Jones has been on the show, and obviously she knows infinitely more than I do about this. I'll tell you a mistake I've made, Ollen. I wonder whether you've either can relate to this or whether you just think, what has he been doing here? Right, so let's imagine you're teaching something for 2 weeks, whatever it may be, straight line graphs, fractions or whatever. By the end of that 2 week block, you would hope that you're going a bit deeper into the concept. You're asking students much more challenging questions. Maybe they're generating their own examples. Maybe you're weaving in other areas of maths. All the contextual stuff's coming in, all that kind of stuff. But my fear then is when we jump to retrieval practice, so whenever I want to review fractions in a do now or a low stakes quiz, I seem to, by default, jump back to the procedural. So I jump back to, you know, just adding two fractions together, whatever it may be. And my fear is that students only ever go deep at the time when they're studying the topic, and then retrieval becomes almost this kind of shallow level of knowledge. So what I've been trying to do now is build in a variety of questions into retrieval practice. So you do now, it may have a couple of procedural questions in there, but also then it's going to have either a problem solving or a generating examples or give me a boundary example or a non-example of this and so on. Because my fear is, if retrieval is always this procedural shallow level stuff, the message we communicate to kids there isn't great, right? It's, you know, this is the only level you need to learn this at. So just a kind of thought and reflection on my own poor practice. Does that resonate with you at all?
Yeah, that's a really good point, Craig. I guess my thoughts on that is that retrieval, the function of retrieval can be thought of in a few different ways. And I mean, this is something that I've learned from my own language learning, right? So I mentioned learning Mandarin before. I'm trying to learn a bit of German at the moment. And what I've found, like, I use a spaced repetition software called Anki. It has, like, you know, phrases in German with a missing word that's then in English, and I have to retrieve the German version to complete the sentence fully in German. And I find that those cards are usually created. They're created by me from a rich learning environment. I might be listening to a podcast, I might be reading an article or a short story or a news article, something like that. So it comes out of it comes from context. Then I take it out of that context and I create kind of retrieval cards for myself. Initially, it's quite a meaningful card because I can kind of remember the story. But over time, the context kind of falls away and it becomes this, like, disjointed, like abstract by itself kind of a thing, unless it's from like quite a meaningful chat or something. Like I've got a few cards I made from my recent trip to Germany, and I think they'll retain the context for a bit longer. But it's also understanding like how much to expect from a trigal practice. So what I've learned is that Anki with language learning is absolutely fantastic for keeping the knowledge of a word kind of at the edge of my retrievability, such that when I do actually encounter it in a proper context again, it's not like it's a completely, pardon the pun, foreign word. It's actually, I'm like, oh, I know that word, or there's a level of familiarity. And then I need to check the definition, or maybe I hear it a couple of times in a couple of different sentences, and that's enough for me to go, oh, that's right, it means this thing. And so I often actually see retrieval as a bit of a placeholder to kind of just maintain this base level of familiarity with the content, such that, you know, when we do spend, you know, 15 minutes on it in a good classroom context, say you're going to teach another lesson where you know you're going to actually draw on that, in this example, vocab, or in the maths example, some other skill, you can quickly activate prior knowledge, and then you can build upon it. Whereas if you hadn't done that retrieval in between, the strength of that memory would have degraded so much that you wouldn't have been activating prior knowledge, you'd be reteaching. And so that relates back to the comment I was making earlier in terms of like the scope of learning that we expect, and retrieval can be seen in some contexts, unless it's really, really thorough, but if it's a quick thing done at the start, it can sometimes be valuable to see it as like a maintenance kind of a task for that knowledge, which is only worthwhile though if you're actually going to build on it later. Because if you actually don't build on it later, then it does become this completely disconnected and irrelevant piece of information, and quite frankly, a bit of a waste of time, because students will forget it.
All right, Tom, what is tip number two, please?
Tip number two is backwards plan, always backwards plan. So this, I mean, the first level of this, level one of this tip is for people teaching to high stakes exams. Right. So in my first year of teaching, I came into a school. There were very few resources, and I had to try to work out. It was actually my second year that I started teaching, year 12, which is like the high stakes year here in Australia. I had to work out really quickly what on earth I needed to teach my students for them to be able to have success in the end of year exam. A similar thing has happened to myself when I was like at uni and I was doing a couple of subjects, and either there were clashes, so I couldn't go to the lectures of one, or I'd just been completely slack and left it till 2 weeks before the exam to try to work out what was going on. In both cases, there's a common approach, which is in the lecture scenario, like go through all the lectures or read all the chapters in the textbook and then try and perform the exam. Or in the teaching example, look at the curriculum, try to work out what's going on, look at the textbook, use that. And try to prepare your students using those resources that other people, ideally experts, have created to prepare for the exam. But, this may be obvious to some people, but over the years it's taken me a while to realize that actually the hurdle, the bar we're trying to jump over is actually that examination. And this is obviously in the restricted sense of teaching, but when we are focused on that particular goal, hopefully we're balancing with others, but when we're focusing on that goal, that's the bar we've got to jump over. So backwards planning essentially just means work out, do a massive audit of what is in past exams and use that as your teaching guide. So what this looked like for me in that first year teaching, year 12, when I had very little support to do it, is literally printing out single-sided a whole heap of past exams, like as about 10 years worth, physically cutting up every single question, and then, you know, getting on the math staff room floor over one weekend and just moving them into piles that seemed to make sense and be related, and then sequencing those piles and then relating those piles back to the study design. And then when I looked at the study design and it had some strange thing like, you know, make a adjacency matrix from a network diagram or something like that, I could go, okay, oh, that's actually what they're talking about, this is the thing. Or it's some other abstract point where you're like, well, that could that could be taken to eternity. You know, you could keep on analyzing that idea forever. It's like, well, actually, they're only going to ask you to analyze it in three different ways. And so by doing that, I was able to very, very quickly ascertain exactly the level of difficulty that was required of my students, or the level of capability that was required of my students, teach to that and have a reasonable amount of success in that first year of teaching, and similarly have a reasonable amount of success in my uni subjects, even when I had slacked off on a couple of them throughout the semester. So that's the kind of level one of this takeaway. I think the level two of this takeaway is when we do broaden out the question of what are we backwards planning to. So I think the application of that backwards planning idea is very crystal clear when we think about an actual exam. But you know, what's the goal of school? Well, I don't know, but one of the kind of goals is to prepare students for life more broadly. And if we backwards plan from life to school, what is it useful for the majority of students to know? So I don't know. I'm actually curious to ask you, Craig, in the last month or two, what maths have you used? And, you know, talking blasphemy here, people, so get ready. What maths have you used in your real life?
Oh, flipping heck, Ollie. You know, I'm supposed to be asking the questions here, right? You're not allowed to just spring these on me. Well, I'll tell you what, I can give a bit of a cheat answer, only because I've been doing a lot of maths with my little boy, Isaac, but that's kind of in a bit of an inauthentic context. We learnt about negative numbers this morning, absolutely blew his mind, so that was nice. But in terms of day-to-day maths, not counting up my YouTube viewers for this, trying to project upwards, you know, when I'm going to hit some certain milestone, but not a massive math. I do quite a lot of recreational maths, Ollie. I'm a bit of a geek with that kind of stuff, so I like that kind of thing, but I won't be doing that much kind of authentic maths, I guess, day to day. How come?
Oh, I'm just trying to backwards plan from life as to what we should be teaching, for example, our disengaged year nine students. You know, like, what should we be like? So I do use maths in my life. I kind of did a bit of brainstorm before I chat today. One of the areas is around financial stuff. The idea of mortgages and amortization, I think about a fair bit. And so I need to have a general sense of what's going on there. Investment and debt are hugely important issues. I was chatting with a friend the other day and they were trying to work out whether to pay off some loans or not. And the basic principle there is, you know, do you expect that the money you've taken out on the loan, can you earn a higher return than the interest rate? And if you can, then maybe keep the loan. If you can't, then probably pay it off. Time's really important, and a lot of people struggle with time, just telling the time. Percentages and the ability to use them, heaps, ratios, the ability to use them, and dimensional analysis. I don't know if this is something people have heard of, but just the idea that you can actually use the units from a question or a scenario to help you work out how to work it out. That's something I actually used a fair bit when I'm working at the prices of things or various ratios. And the final thing is like spreadsheets. I use spreadsheets a hell of a lot. I'm always summing stuff up. I'm also always doing other weird stuff that like concatenation and weighted averages and things like that. And you know, lots of teachers use a lot of those functionalities as well. So yeah, I guess for me, like this idea of backwards planning, level one, helps us to jump through hoops. And helps our students jump through hoops. But level two helps us to ask which hoops should we be jumping through and which hoops should we be trying to help our students, or hurdles should we be trying to help our students to jump over. Now, to be clear, you know, this isn't a criticism of particularly anything in the primary curriculum. I think number sense and things like that is absolutely crucial, and the way that primaries generally do that is really valuable. But I think secondary, there's some questions that should be asked, and it's pretty productive to ask those questions. But I mean, again, this sounds like blasphemy. So to approach it one other way, that people who think I'm talking blasphemy might find valuable, it's to quote Dylan William. And that's to say that education is about opportunity costs, right? So it's not about whether it's valuable for year nine to learn trigonometry or year nines. No doubt it is. The question is there something that they could be learning that would be more valuable during that time? And I think I think that's a question we don't ask enough, and I think it's a question worth asking. The answer might be, well, actually, no, algebra is the best use of, or trigonometry or whatever is the best use of that year nine time. But I have a sneaking suspicion, maybe not, and maybe not for the whole maths curriculum that we have. So that's the thing I'd love listeners to keep in the back of their mind. It's not an argument against maths or the value of maths. It's an argument for a conscious consideration of opportunity cost.
Love it, Ollie. Right, okay, one reflection and two questions on this. So first, this was bad, right? So I remember however many years ago it was, I got asked to teach a new, something I'd never taught before, further maths was what our kids do years 12 and 13. And I never taught further maths before. I was always dead excited to do it. But the way I decided to teach it was the opposite. Well, the way I planned it was the opposite of what you did, right? So I didn't look at any exams. I just had the textbook and I tried to stay just kind of one chapter ahead of the kids. So the only exposure the kids would get to practice was the practice questions from the textbook. Anyway, it got to the exam. We started doing past papers and it was nothing like the textbook whatsoever. And I'm thinking, bloody hell. Anyway, it turned out okay. But the next year, it was very much exam focused. It was very much, yeah, let me get a sense of what kids need to do. And you see this with experienced teachers, right? They just know how to pitch things. They know what to put emphasis on and what not to put emphasis on because they've taught a course for many years. The flip side of that is a few years ago in the UK, our GCSE, so the exam our kids take at the end of year 11, the spec changed for that. So nobody had any exams to go off. And the exam boards would release a couple of kind of sample papers. And then you had a real dilemma because you have a real small sample size of things to go off. So do you just put all your eggs in one basket and teach, you know, to the kind of standard and the way these questions are styled? Or do you just kind of think, no, we don't, that's too small a sample size. Do we just do what we've always done and hope it still works? And it was a real dilemma. So having a big batch of those final summative tests is really beneficial. But the flip side of that, Ollie, and this was the first question I wanted to ask you, is how does that play out for lower years? So, you know, your, you know, grade threes, grade fours, who don't have this end of year exam. How do you know how can you backwards plan with them?
It's a good question. I've done a bit of this in schools. I just keep on going backwards, basically. So saying, you know, we've identified what our year 12s need to be successful. What prior knowledge do they need such that when students come into year 12, when they're exposed to that content, it's not going to be too big of a jump, and you just work your way backwards. That becomes the kind of core stuff that, you know, like to create successful quote unquote students, when we're talking about in terms of marks, that, you know, if we build our curriculum based upon this, it's going to be successful. And then, but depending upon how rich you feel that is, how much time, additional time you feel you have, you can add in the other stuff that you feel is likely more important or equally important. But hopefully, if exams are written well, the content contained within them represents the kind of key ideas and concepts from a domain such that if you do eventually backwards map from that all the way down to year seven or something, you're still gonna have a lot of quality content there.
Got it. And final question on this, Al. Does this strategy of backwards planning, does this apply on the kind of per lesson basis as well? If you were thinking of teaching a lesson, would you start at where you want the kids to get to at the end of the lesson and go from there, or does it not kind of transfer down?
Yeah, so it's like Oliver Caviglioli is good about this. It's like put ideas in containers or concepts in containers and sequence them along a path. So the concepts will be those past exam questions, you put them in containers of related concepts, then you'll sequence them along a path, which will become your kind of learning sequence. And then you basically just cut that up into bite-sized chunks that represent lessons. That's kind of the way that I look at it.
Fantastic. Right, Ol, what's tip number three, please?
Tip number three. So tip number three comes from, I've talked to lots of people over the years on the ERR podcast, and when I've asked quite a few pretty switched on people, including like Tom Sherrington, what's the absolute most important thing for teachers to do? And the answer is check for understanding. Okay. If you're not checking for understanding, you're not working out the difference between what you think you're teaching and what your students are actually taking from the lesson. Thought of thinking about this in another way. Dylan William has essentially dedicated his whole career to checking for understanding. That's basically what formative assessment is, but they're not just checking for understanding, actually acting on the data that you collect from that checking for understanding. So, I mean, what does that mean practically? It just means things like COCOA, it means mini whiteboards, it means stuff like Desmos, teaching students to check understanding for themselves. It means stuff like I had Paul Spensley, a science teacher on the podcast, helping students to analyze the types of errors they're making, things like that. You know, there's teacher checking for understanding, peer and self understanding. A great quote from Dylan William in a recent podcast is, good feedback works towards its own redundancy. So checking for understanding in a way, and supporting students to check for understanding in a way such that you don't need to keep on doing it for them, but they start to do it for themselves. Coming back to that learning to learn kind of thing we were talking about is really valuable. So that's kind of the level one of this takeaway. The level two helps us understand why it's really so important. Check for understanding is the basis of working out what works in education. You know, if we think about what is a research study is essentially a systematic approach to checking for understanding. You do something to one group, you do something different to another group, then you check for understanding to see what works. So if we do nothing else, if we never teach teachers in teacher education how to do anything, we only taught them to check for understanding, they would derive pretty much every instructional principle that we have and every technique, because they would know what's working along the way and they would know what's not working. And step back even further, check for understanding in many ways is essentially the scientific method. So at the classroom level, we need to check for understanding to know what's going on in our lesson, but that process, that cycle of trying stuff out and checking if it's actually working is the basis of all learning, both inside and outside of education.
Love it all. Biggie, this one, right? Okay, so a few things from me here. So first, just a reflection. I think you're right. One of the things you said early on really resonates with me, this, that the response to that check for understanding, if you're not doing that, you might as well not bother with the check for understanding. And when Jo Morgan was on the Tips for Teachers podcast a while ago, she said that whenever you go to CPD about responsive teaching and checking for understanding, the emphasis is always on the check for understanding. It's not so much on the responding, because the responding bit's dead hard, right? Like if you've got half your kids know it and half your kids don't, that's when you've really got to think what you're going to do. So yeah, if you're going to check for understanding, preparing in advance how you're going to respond for different scenarios feels really, really important. And two follow-up questions on this all. So you mentioned lots of different kind of mechanisms for checking for understanding, cold call, mini whiteboards, and so on and so forth. And this often comes up a lot on the podcast, particularly mini whiteboards. If there was a drinking game on the Tips for Teachers podcast, it'd be have a shot every time somebody mentions mini whiteboards. After the Adam Boxer episode, everyone would be hammered. But the thing I think about a lot here is, why if you had mini whiteboards available so you could elicit responses from all your kids, would you ever cold call? Where's the argument for cold calling if you can get all responses?
That's a really great question. I haven't thought about that before. And it's relevant to me because I do both use mini whiteboards and I cold call things. I think I'd say it depends upon timing, like how much time you have. It also depends upon the type of answer. So mini whiteboards are great in a time press scenario when you're doing like multiple choice questions, when you're doing single answer questions, single word questions, things like that. The pace of the lesson kind of slow and things can get bogged down a little bit as soon as you start doing like extended written answers. Now, mini whiteboards are excellent for that because you can overcome the transient information effect and you can take a student's written answer, you can put it under a visualizer, project it up on the board and edit it and go through it. And that's awesome as well. But also, I think there's a benefit to getting students to verbalize their thinking, to vocalize it, and it kind of enables a bit more of a dynamic kind of problem solving and discussion and refinement in the moment as well. So yeah, and also, you know, if you're trying to just quickly go through, like often I'll often use cold calling when I'm actually doing like a second worked example. So I'll do the first worked example, I'll explain every step. Then I'll have my popsticks in one hand and my marker in the other, and I'll do the first line of working and say, what am I going to do next? Craig, And Craig will hopefully tell me, oh, that's exactly right. Blah, 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 blah. What am I going to do next based upon the first work example? Harry. And Harry will tell me. So I think it's really good for that snappy stuff. Whereas if I said, what's the next step? Everyone meaning whiteboards, it would be like 30 seconds later. You know, and what are they going to write? Divide both sides by three or a symbol or like, you know. So I think there's that kind of in the moment, just keeping everyone engaged kind of popstick thing that I really like using. But then it's like, okay, we're all now going to do a you do, and I'm going to check if like 80% or more of the class knows before I set you on independent work, and then I'll know who to follow up with, or I'll know if like lots of people don't understand, and then I can go through another couple of examples.
Got it. Fantastic. I've actually just a couple of two bonus reflections before I ask you this last thing. First is, I'm a big fan now. I call this the holy trinity of checking for understanding. I love this now. So it's the combo of you ask a question. I like the kids to do, if it's like a more extended thing, the working out on the back of the mini whiteboards and then the final answer on the front of the whiteboards. And then I'll say, okay, 3, 2, 1, hold them up. So I get a bit of a sense of what's going on. And then without me evaluating it in any way, then they discuss with their partners, compare what's the same, what's different. And then I warm call based on what I've seen on the whiteboard. So you're getting almost, it slows things down, but you're getting the best of all the world. You've got the whole class response, you've got the paired discussion. Then you go, because I agree with you, the big advantage for me of cold call is you get that verbal interaction. They can refine the responses as well. Well, so I love that. I'm going to patent that. I think Holy Trinity as a phrase has been taken already, but if I can get the Holy Trinity of checking for understanding that, I think we're laughing there. Second thing I was going to say, this is a big shout out to you, Ollie, for one of your interviews and also your excellent book. Was it Anita Archer who was talking about the importance of we do? And I always cut out the we do, you know, when I'm doing a worked example. I always go from worked example to a your turn straight away. And it was only when I listened to that conversation, and then particularly I found powerful when I read your book and you all almost kind of scripted out an example of a we do, where you can really play around with the different means of participation, a bit of call and response, a bit of maybe mini whiteboards, a bit of cold call. I thought that was really powerful. So as a key check for understanding within the worked example process, I think the we do is really important. But the final question I was going to say to you is, and it relates back to something we discussed earlier on, Ollie, do you think it's important to vary the types of questions we ask when we check for understanding? Because again, I'm guilty of this. I use a lot of diagnostic questions, and they're very good at identifying single steps and multi-step procedures. You can do a bit of the conceptual stuff as well, but it's more kind of procedural. Or if I do like mini whiteboard stuff, as you've alluded to, it tends to be more of a kind of procedural question. And I just fear, same with the retrieval, that unless we're kind of testing the depth of understanding by varying these questions around a bit, maybe we're only getting a sense of that kind of surface level. So where do you stand on kind of different types of questions you ask to check for understanding?
Yeah, it's a good question. And again, not something I've thought about heaps. But I think maybe that's just because it's kind of different concepts and different understandings lend themselves to checking them in different ways. And this is kind of back to that extraneous versus intrinsic cognitive kind of an idea. It's a question of asking like what's intrinsic, what's at the heart of the knowledge that we're trying to check for understanding, because you're going to get that. And then that's then going to determine how you're going to check for that understanding. So some things, if it's more of an interrelated kind of a concept that has multiple moving parts, you probably need some kind of verbal kind of dialogic thing or some written response. Whereas if it's literally what's the first step and why, that can be a diagnostic question. But I think also good questioners in any scenario will always probe. So, you know, a misconception is revealed, and then the probing will start into exactly the root of that. And that helps to direct how the kind of responsive teaching follows. Because if you're just like, oh, yep, you picked B, that means you have, well, it, to be fair, in diagnostic questions, it probably does actually just mean that they have that misconception. But even then, asking a student to articulate it can help you to kind of head it off even more directly. So yeah, I think to summarize, the content determines how to check for understanding.
Love it. Right, Al, what is tip number four, please?
Tip four, you mentioned previously mechanisms. So tip four is inquire into mechanisms. So, you know, you might have tried something in the classroom. or that your school may have mandated that you do something in the classroom, and you may get a good result or you may get a bad result. Usually what we do there is we say, oh, that worked, or oh, that didn't work. But inquiring into mechanisms is essentially a nudge for us to go a bit deeper and to actually ask the why. So for example, I mean, an interesting example is using your kind of silent worked examples, Craig. You know, it's like, okay, I do silent worked examples and students learn more. That's cool, like if that's the case, but we need to then, well, we can then ask the question, why is that? Is it because they have increased focus and there's less distraction in the classroom? Well, if so, maybe actually there's a better way to do that than being silent. Don't know. Is it because they're actually systematically following every step of working that you're doing? Is that the active ingredient? If so, awesome. But maybe there's a better way. Maybe Michael Pershing's approach is better. Maybe it is actually the silence. Maybe there's something about silence that helps students learn maths. I don't know, in which case you couldn't take that silence away. So when we inquire into mechanisms, we actually work out what part of the thing that we do is most likely to be generating the effect. And this is really valuable. It's valuable for a number of reasons. It's valuable because it helps us to make more reliable predictions of the future. Because if we know what the active ingredient is, we know if it's taken out, it's probably not going to work as well. It allows us to modify strategies and approaches without lethal mutations, which is a phrase that gets bandied around a lot these days. But, you know, a recipe is very, very good in a stable environment. But unfortunately, teaching is not a stable environment. Different students, different days, different weather, different cohorts, different amount of sleep that you've had. And all these things are factors. But if we're aware of the core part of what we're trying to do that generates the effect, we can actually adapt what we're doing in such a way that it hopefully has the intended effect, even through those adaptations. And in relating to adaptation, it enables us to save energy, time, resources. Because maybe there's a strategy we're doing that has 10 steps, some feedback approach or whatever it may be, and we know we've been doing it for 5 years. It always gets really good action from the students or responses from the students, good learning. But maybe there's only 3 of those steps that actually have an impact, and we're doing all these other things like cutting up the staples or like using different colored highlighters. That's actually a complete waste of time. So that's that takeaway. I can't remember what we're up to. 4, 3, 4, 5 now. Inquire into mechanisms. That's a level 1. Level 2 of this takeaway is, I don't actually know what a mechanism is. So to expand on that, one paper that talked about mechanisms a lot last year, October last year, was the one by EEF run by Sam Sims. And their definition of mechanisms, a phrase that they use interchangeably with active ingredients, was an active ingredient is a component of PD that could not be removed or altered without changing the impact of the PD on teaching and learning. Now that sounds sensible. That kind of relates to what I was saying, but does that mean that oxygen is an active ingredient of PD? I definitely agree that if you remove the oxygen of the PD, that would likely change the effect. But oxygen itself is like an entity. It's like an element within. It's not, is it a mechanism? I thought that the mechanism is something about the like causality. So maybe it's about the connection between. So that's confusing me a little bit. Then I thought, all right, maybe I know that a really good way to describe mechanisms is with like if-then statements. So if we were thinking about cold call, I gave a presentation at the Step Lab conference recently. I was trying to look into dissect the mechanisms of a cold call. And this is one of the definitions that was come up with using the if-then framework. If students are sufficiently motivated to appear knowledgeable to the class, then knowing that they may be asked a question at any time will drive them to engage with it and prepare an answer, right? So that's one approach. Another approach of describing mechanisms is using the by statement, which is, I think, Bambrick-Santoyo. So coming back to cold call, sustain a high level of student focus throughout the lesson by making it unpredictable when the students will be asked a question, right? But then when I started to think about and dissect that more, I mean, those things, they seem pretty clear. It's like makes sense. Part of the mechanism of cold call. Another one is the check for understanding part, of course. But then I started to think, well, maybe there's, is there actually anything different than between a mechanism and just having a goal and a step? So the goal could be help students attend to instruction more, and the step is make it unpredictable when you call on them. Like, what part of the goal versus step is the mechanism? Is it like the in-between part? Is it how they come together? Is it, I don't know, Craig, I'm confused. What is a mechanism? So I think some other hypotheses I had were like, maybe it's your ability to answer a number of why questions in between. So that shows you've got to understand. But it's kind of like this, I don't know. I've read a lot of stuff about mechanisms recently, and I think they're really important. I just don't really know what they are. But maybe that's love. You know, love's really important, but like, what the heck is love? So maybe, you know, mechanisms are important as love. I don't know. Anyway, that's the level two. I'm confused.
Ooh, we're going deep. I like this. So again, usual thing, one reflection from me, then one question. Something you hit on really early on, I've done this lots. You change too much, and you can't, I mean, even changing one thing, it's hard to identify what impact it's had to dissect it. But as soon as you start changing two or three things, it's just a disaster waiting to happen. And I have this myself. You listen to a podcast like your own, or you go to a CPD session, you get two or three different ideas. You think, right, I'm going to implement those tomorrow. And then the lesson either goes well and you don't know why, or it's a disaster and you don't know why, because you've changed too many variables. So certainly it feels, before we get to the nitty gritty of mechanisms, it feels important just to narrow that change down to just one thing if possible. The second kind of reflection before I ask you the question is also, sometimes when we change something, well, almost inevitably when we change something, we have to stop doing something else. And I think that often gets overlooked a little bit. We may inadvertently stop doing the one thing that was making all the difference. Silent teacher is a good example of this. It may be that the teacher speaking at that initial exposure to an example is the key thing. And if we take that away and replace it with silent teacher, maybe silent teacher brings another benefit to it, but we've removed a really key thing. So it's always worth reflecting on what, and sometimes it's hard to spot, what have we taken away here to replace it with this new idea? But here's my question for you all. With all the fact that you're confused about these mechanisms, and I don't have a bloody clue, I can tell you that much for free. What do you do when you're instigating a change then? Or, well, what's your process? Let's say you listen to a podcast or whatever, or you read some research, you want to change something. How do you go about doing it? And how do you know if it works?
It's a good question. I think it's just come back to maybe that thing I was referring to at the end there. It's like, to what extent can you suggest a potential causal connection between the proposed action and the desired outcome? And if you can say that, yes, there's pretty clearly a causal path here, and you can articulate that causal pathway, which is something you would have seen me write about a little bit in Tools for Teacher as well, if you got to that chapter, then I think the mechanism's there. But I guess the confusion for me is like, not whether a mechanism is present or not, but more about like, what part of the causal chain between action and outcome constitutes the mechanism. Is it the whole thing? Is it the step, the mediation? Is it the moderation? Is it the goal? Is it the action? I don't know.
It's interesting. This just one final reflection on this all. And it's really interesting you brought up silent teacher here, because sometimes I see two different things going on when you try and bring in silent teacher. So the first is, often you get like a honeymoon period where the kids, because it's so novel, they're just like, what is this? And their full attention's on it. So the danger there is, you do this one or two times, you think, I've cracked it. This is the revolution I've been waiting for. But then obviously the novelty wears off, and then maybe kids go back to being a little bit more disengaged and so on and so forth. So I think when you bring in something new, be aware of the honeymoon period. But then also, and I think we talked about this last time when you were talking about Tools for Teachers on my Mr. Barton Maths podcast, this notion of this valley of latent potential. When you bring in a new idea, often there's a big lag before you start to see the benefits of it, because it's not been embedded. And students are really focused on the structure of the idea versus the content of the idea and so on. So that's just two added extra complications, right? When you try and make a change, you've got to be aware of this honeymoon period and aware of this kind of, you know, valley of latent potential. So you may only see whether this is working. It may take a month or something like that. And if it's not working, that's a month's gone by, you know, where, you know, the opportunity cost, your kids could have been doing something more effective. It's tricky, isn't it? But yeah, have you considered that, this honeymoon and this latent potential? It feels like they're two kind of competing factors that come into play when we try and make a change.
Yeah, Yeah, it's huge. And I mean, that relates as well to another really important point about mechanisms, and that's the Hawthorne effect. So this is something they've found in a lot of studies, simply by the act of conducting a study. If people know they're being studied, they try harder at whatever the thing is. I think traditionally it was kind of factory workers and their productivity. It's like change the lighting in the factory. The workers are like, oh, someone's watching us and measuring what we're doing, so we better act. And so, like, what's the mechanism there? Well, watching, surveillance, essentially. So often it's really quite difficult to kind of split it apart. I was going to say something else, but I've completely forgotten what it was.
It's tricky, isn't it? Well, just that last final bit, all then, just to dig into it practically. Let's say, for example, after our chat today, you think, right, I'm going to go for it with this silent teacher. Forget Persian. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Silent teacher is the way forward. How would you determine whether it works or not? Like, what are you looking, and over what period are you looking for it to get this data back?
Good question. First, I'll say the thing that I remembered I was going to say before. What I was going to say before was this valley of latent potential is particularly prevalent when we come back to that learning to learn or self-regulated learning stuff, right? Because teaching, like, there are a few things quicker and more direct route in terms of getting students to high performance than highly structured instruction where the teacher is 100% in the driver's seat and the students are working really hard to keep up the whole time and they manage to keep up. I think that can, you know, and we see a lot of really effective explicit instruction going on, and that's absolutely fantastic and a really important tool for teachers to have in their toolbox. But again, opportunity cost, if we do that 100% of the time, we miss out on a lot of the potential gains and the longer term benefits in particular of creating more independent learners. But when at the time we're trying to make that transition, should I say, we're likely to see a significant dip in scores for an extended period of time. Which brings us back to the other question you just asked. How do you know if it's working? Well, check for understanding. check for understanding. But the other part you asked was over kind of what period of time. I don't know, Craig. To me, it kind of comes back to the... It does come back to mechanisms. Does it seem like the effect that you're expecting is happening? And does it seem like it's plausible that it's happening because of the reason that you think it's happening? But also, a lot of teaching isn't all quantifiable. And sometimes you have to just get a sense of things.
Absolutely. Right, Ol, fifth and final tip, please.
Tip number five, Craig, you can learn something from everybody. Let's start with a syllogism. Syllogisms are kind of logical puzzles, if you will. I'm going to give you a few, Craig.
Oh, jeez.
All right. This is the classic one. So the challenge with a syllogism is to work out if it's valid. If the logical thread within the syllogism is valid or invalid, is the logical thread broken? So first one, very, very famous syllogism. Socrates is a man. All men are moral. Therefore, Socrates is moral. Sorry, I said moral. I meant to say mortal. Socrates is a man, but hopefully Socrates is moral. And this relates to something else I was going to talk. Morality is something else I was going to talk about, but I think I forgot to. Socrates is a man. All men are mortal. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. Listeners at home can play as long as well. Do you think that was a completely logical conclusion from the two statements? Talk us through your thinking, Craig.
Oh, geez. Right. Okay. Socrates is a man. That was the first one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And all men are mortal. This is why I don't like having you on the show, Ollie, because most guests, I can just ask them questions. I can have a little sit off. Socrates is a man.
Uh-huh.
All men are mortal. So it follows that Socrates is mortal. Yeah. Yeah. That's got to be complete, surely.
Is it? Socrates is a man. I forgot to check the answer in the back of the book for this one. I thought I knew it, but now you're confusing me. Socrates is a man. All men are mortal.
Yeah.
Therefore, yeah. So it's man to mortal, Socrates mortal. Okay, I think that's valid. And if we're both wrong, then shame on us and someone better write in. All right, here's another one for you, Craig.
Sorry, the pain's not over.
This is again for listeners at home. All students' natural discovery should be supported. All students' natural discovery should be supported. Some inquiry-based teaching should be supported. Therefore, some inquiry-based teaching leads to students' natural discovery.
No, that feels like it doesn't quite. I'm kind of drawing circles here almost like a bit of a Venn diagram. That feels like there's some gaps. I'm going to say that's not.
You reckon that's valid? All right, let's try that. Let's try another one. All learning is a change in long-term memory. Some changes to long-term memory should be strengthened by testing. Therefore, something that should be strengthened by testing is learning.
Oh, dear. Give that to me one more time, Alf.
Hope everyone at home's having fun as well. All learning is a change in long-term memory.
Yeah.
Some changes to long-term memory should be strengthened by testing.
Yep.
Therefore, something that should be strengthened by testing is learning.
I don't know this one, Ollie. It's certainly not as tight as old Socrates. I was all over him, you know. I was hoping for a few more of them. I don't know this one. I don't like this word something chucked in there. It's I don't know this one, Ollie.
You don't know?
Do you know this one is the bigger question?
I think I do. I actually cross-checked this with like a philosophy lecturer at a university who teaches logic, and she did
nice.
Give me the answer. If you had to take a punt, totally fine if you're wrong. If you had to take a punt.
Yeah, I'd say this one. See, this is my own bias, right? Because I love a bit of long-term memory and testing. I'd say this one is pretty solid, but I'm not convinced.
Cool. So this is a educational version of a real study that was done by a Russian researcher whose name I can't pronounce. I'm not going to try to. And it was researching a thing called my side bias. And my side bias is our ability to evaluate the logic of statements or the validity of research and things like that, and the influence that our prior beliefs have on our ability to objectively evaluate things. So for you, Craig, it would be my hypothesis that you would be more likely to classify that third logical syllogism as valid based upon your priors, and less likely to classify the middle syllogism as valid because of your priors. The opposite would be different for someone. The opposite would be the case for someone else. It is in fact the case that both the second and third syllogisms were invalid. I'm so glad that worked. That was just like so
good
neat,
twist.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, that was good. That was good. That all. Yeah, I fell into that one. Yeah, it was good.
So the point here, you know, you can learn something from everybody. What the heck do these syllogisms have? To me, one of the biggest challenges in education is our inability to listen to each other. There is something that you can learn from everybody. I just came back from a trip to the UK. I visited three schools. They were the most different schools I could find in England. I visited the self-managed learning college, which is a school with absolutely no curriculum, almost no structure. They only have structures around the kind of meeting in the morning and the afternoon. I visited XP, which does explicit instruction, but it also does expeditionary learning. And it also has a big focus on pastoral stuff. And then I visited Michaela, which is, you know, famously the strictest school in the UK. And I learned stuff from all three of them. And it was great. But the point of these syllogisms is if we do actually find ourselves in a corner, in a particular educational paradigm or educational corner or something like that, and we start to associate ourselves and our beliefs with a certain way of thinking or a certain brand or something like that, it doesn't only have a kind of impact in terms of who our friends are and kind of what we choose to engage with. It also actually means that if we do say, all right, I'm actually going to have a crack and try to understand this other side of the story, like, we're actually incapable of objectively analyzing the facts. Like, you just can't get past it. It's my side bias. And so to me, the only way around that, the only potential way around it, because there's probably no full way around it, the way to lessen the impact is to try to be knowledge driven rather than belief driven. And this is a big distinction. A lot of people, it's like my goal is to have a bit of a have an impact, or my goal is to be a good teacher or whatever it might be. That might be a belief driven, but if we're knowledge driven and it's like, my goal is to truly understand the mechanisms behind this, it's to truly understand, like, whether when I check for understanding, my students have learnt more or not, it's to truly understand the argument of this person I disagree with, or I feel like I might disagree with, that's the only way we can start to circumvent this. One other point on this, Dylan William has a great quote, which he said it in my podcast, and I have it in Tools for Teachers. He said, test the measure of a researcher by asking, what are two or more research results that you believe and trust, but that you do not like? I think is another great question. And he said in his case, the two were the importance of IQ for educational achievement, and even more depressingly, its heritability. And the second is cognitive load theory. He wished that problem solving was best taught through problem solving. That's that takeaway. That's level one of that takeaway. You can learn something from everybody. The level two here is that change in the world often depends upon zealots, right? And I can't remember it exactly, but I think it's a George Bernard Shaw quote. Tim Ferriss is pretty fond of it. You're probably familiar with it too, Craig. It's something like the reasonable man adapts himself to the world. The unreasonable man tries to adapt the world to himself. So that's one way to put it. And another way is, you know, often the people who create these interesting schools, like the reason why Michaela exists and the reason why the self-managed learning college exists, is because there are people out there who have such conviction about their beliefs that they're willing to put everything on the line, reputation, finances, family, relationships, to actually create something in line with those beliefs. And if everyone was, you know, pontificating about what the true answer to everything is, we probably wouldn't end up with these phenomenal schools that take completely different directions, but that actually help us to have a clear understanding of what works, or more importantly, what works for whom, under what circumstances, for what purpose, how, and compared to what, to quote Adrian Simpson, and add a little bit as well. You know, being knowledge-driven is great, being belief-driven is great as well. Everybody wins, but most importantly, you can learn something from everyone.
Great, that all. That's fantastic. One reflection, one question. So first things, I always like that mantra, find someone smart who you disagree with. I always like that. Like, find real smart people who have the alternative view and just try and listen to them. So there's got to be some basis to it. So I like that. And my second question, this will be my final question for you all. You mentioned those three schools. Just give me just one takeaway from each, something that you learned from each that maybe either surprised you or has influenced your practice.
Sure. Okay. Self-managed learning college. A belief in students, in a young person's ability to self-govern, and like an unfaltering belief in that, can actually unlock phenomenal things in young people.
That's okay. Just what age were these kids at?
I think it's like 9 to 16.
Wow. Okay, that's good. Yeah, I'd love to see that. That's great.
It's a pretty interesting place. XP. XP, it's just like, if you get relationships right, so much else follows. Some would say everything else follows, but so much follows when you get that right. And Michaela, you don't know what high standards are until you've been to Michaela. Have you been there?
Not yet. No, I can't wait.
It is madness, mate. It's absolutely madness. So, yeah.
That's brilliant. Well, they were five absolutely fantastic tips. So let me hand over to you. What should listeners be checking out of yours? And I'll put links to these in the show notes.
Checking out. I'd love it if listeners checked out the Education Research Reading Room podcast. We have lots of fun on there. So much fun I had you on there twice, Craig. People have seemed to enjoy Cognitive Load Theory in Action as a concise and actionable guide to cognitive load theory. If people are keen to go deeper, I have recently released an online course that you can find on my site on called Cognitive Load Theory Mastery. We've had a few people complete that one now, even though it's only been up for a couple of weeks, and I've had some really, really positive feedback. Tools for Teachers is another book that's out now, and it's now even been used in some kind of university initial teacher education courses, and so that's really encouraging that people are finding enough value in that. But apart from that, just remember you can learn something from everybody.
That's lovely, that, Alan. Just a final thing from me. I am just two episodes of yours that one I revisited and one I listened to for the first time. So I love your Doug Lamarve interview is fantastic. So I love the structure that you do with that, where you give yourself a little timer to get through. And he really embraces that as well. That's really good. And what I liked about that, like, Doug's must have been interviewed thousands of times, right? And he's probably been asked the same questions, but he really warmed to that structure, that challenge of having to be concise. And you got through so much practical stuff from that. So I thought it was a wonderful episode. One of the things I'm trying to do at the moment is, instead of consuming new content, make sure I revisit content that I've got something out of in the past, just with this old classic speak to your condition, because you probably take something new from it and so on. And that was a definite example of that. But particularly when he talked about paired work and stopping paired work almost too soon, riding this crest of the wave because you don't want it to kind of fizzle out, things like that. I thought it was a wonderful interview. And then you'll have to forgive me here because I've forgotten the name of the guy, but you alluded to it early on, the science teacher guy you had on. What was his name, Al?
Paul Spenceley.
Yeah, he was good, hey. He was good. I really, really enjoyed that about kind of formative assessment and stuff. So I'll put links to both of those in the show notes because they were great. Well, it's always been a pleasure speaking to you. Again, I always give a little behind the curtain appearance here. So you've got, last time we were on the podcast, I think you put your name as the best podcaster or something like that. Today you've got the original T4T creator. So what Ollie's claiming here, listeners, is because he's got Tools for Teachers and I'm Tips for Teachers, that there's some kind of legal battle could ensue here. But yeah, Ollie was the first with the T for T, but we'll see what happens in the long term.
I think last time you came on with the original podcaster, I think, Craig. So I just wanted to come back at you with the T for T one.
Well, Ollie Lovell, it is always a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Craig. It's always fun.